From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Recently, the BBC announced a transformation that World Service Director Nigel Chapman called, quote, the most far-reaching since the BBC began international broadcasting more than 70 years ago. The BEEB is shutting down 10 foreign language broadcasts and opening an Arabic language television service in the Middle East. The new service will be available in 2007 and will be free for households with cable or satellite. Jerry Timmons is BBC Chief of Africa and the Middle East, and he joins me now. Jerry, welcome to OTM.
Thanks very much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, I want to ask about what is being sacrificed, and that's the radio broadcasts in Eastern Europe. Why are they deemed no longer necessary?
Well, we're not cutting all of the languages to Eastern Europe, but a significant proportion of them are going. What we did was we looked at all of our language services and our English output as well, and where we identified that there had been sufficient change in the market so that there was more free media available, and where, because of those changes, we were competing less effectively. Over the last 5 years, audiences had declined rather than gone up. We took the tough decision to stop those particular languages.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the role that these Eastern European stations played during the Cold War, because clearly they were an important source of information from the West across the Iron Curtain, where information was tightly controlled. And as a consequence, their Western news and information is widely credited for helping propel the fall of communism. I don't know if there was an explicit political motivation to have those services there to begin with. First of all, was there and is there a parallel in the Arabic language television service?
No, not at all. The BBC World Service is a fundamental part of the wider BBC, and the BBC has never had an agenda like that. The BBC's role under the law that set us up is to provide impartial, balanced, fair information, and people have a hunger for accurate and impartial information, and if the BBC provides that, it gives us a real competitive edge.
Well, on the competitive situation, leaving Eastern Europe, because there are plenty of other media options now available there, but going into the Mideast, where there are, you know, everybody and his brother already has a satellite channel, most especially Al Jazeera, which is, you know, widely viewed and widely respected in the Arab world. Does the Middle East need yet one more satellite TV channel?
Well, we've done a lot of research recently exactly into that point, and the answer is a resounding yes. In 7 countries recently researched, 80 to 85% of respondents were saying that they would be likely or very likely to watch a proposition from the BBC in Arabic on television. And I think that is because the BBC has a trusted reputation in the Middle East. We've been on radio in Arabic for over 60 years. And I think if we do something that is similar in tone and style and adheres to the BBC's values around news, then it will be very distinctive in the marketplace and it will attract people to us.
I've read so much about how the Arab street regards the Western media as little more than the propaganda organ of, for example, the Bush and Blair administrations. Is it truly regarded in the Arab world as an independent voice?
It's true that if you look at the research and you visit the Middle East and you talk to people, the BBC is a trusted voice. We've reported stories accurately that other stations in the Middle East won't touch, and we've reported stories about the British government accurately and impartially, and are highly respected for that as well.
Did the sexed up dossier scandal that so caused you problems in the UK, did it actually work to your advantage in winning the hearts and minds of Arab listeners?
Well, I think people looked at that story, looked at the pressures that were brought to bear on the BBC, looked at the reaction of the organisation and the way in which the BBC reported it back to its audiences and made their own judgments about that. And it was hardly deliberate on our part, but it certainly didn't do us any harm in the Middle East.
In the mid-90s, the BBC had an Arabic television channel, but it closed amid some controversy. Can you tell me about what's changed since then?
In the 90s, when the Arabic television service started from the BBC, it was commercially funded. It was funded by money from a Saudi company, and it ran for 2 years. It had to survive commercially, and we found that we simply couldn't do it. And the editorial pressures in particular that we found ourselves under proved to be intolerable, and we closed the service down because we didn't want to succumb to those pressures.
The he who pays the piper calls the tune pressures.
Yeah, so it was money from a Saudi company, and they were particularly sensitive to some of the stories that we ran about the Saudi regime.
The money for this substantially comes from the British Foreign Office. How are viewers of the BBC Arabic satellite channel supposed to separate independent journalism from British diplomacy?
There is no direct connection between British foreign policy and what the BBC does. We're completely editorially independent. We're legally obliged to be so. And the people who come to work for the BBC are very proud of that fact and wouldn't dream of doing anything else.
Well, Jerry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry Timmons is head of the BBC in Africa and the Middle East.
If you're one of the rapidly dwindling subset of TV viewers without cable, you've no doubt listened to our past discussions of Rupert Murdoch, Bill O'Reilly, and their Fox News comrades, and you've wondered about all you've been missing. Well, dear listener, wonder no more. It looks like Fox News soon could be coming to you free over the air. Planning is underway at Fox's parent company, News Corp, to begin exporting the kinds of offerings now available only on cable to the 35 broadcast stations it owns around the country. Get ready, Family Guy. Here comes Geraldo. Joining me now to talk about what else is coming is Brian Stelter, editor of the blog TV Newser. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you.
So the changes started a couple of months back, right, when Rupert Murdoch's son Lachlan resigned as chief of News Corp's 35 local stations and Fox News chairman Roger Ailes took over.
That's right. Roger Ailes, in the last 10 years, has created Fox News and made it a powerhouse. So Rupert Murdoch turned to him and said, now you're going to do the same thing for my local news stations.
And how does he plan to do that?
In many ways, it's going to be a Foxification of local news and local broadcasting, from morning shows to syndicated shows like Geraldo at Large, possibly a nightly newscast, trying to rejuvenate the lineup.
I understand that he's actually flown editorial staff from local stations to the Fox News headquarters for crash courses in the Fox News method. So what's your best guess as to what's going on in those sessions?
Well, they are producers and anchors. They're being taught how to be conversational on the air the way that anchors like Shep Smith on the Fox News Channel already are. And I think those lessons are just the start of how Roger Ailes and his deputies at Fox News will try to take the Fox News style that's worked so well on cable and put it into the local affiliates.
There's been some talk in the trade press about Fox starting up a broadcast version of its own evening newscast to compete with the big three networks. How real a possibility is that?
I think it's very real and very likely that in a year or two we will see a Fox nightly newscast, a lot like what we've seen now on Fox News at 7 p.m. with the Fox Report. Very fast-paced, very conversational, very engaging. Might have up to 60 stories in the course of an hour. The reason Fox News Channel on cable has been so successful, because it gets its viewers to watch for long periods of time. If they can do that on broadcast as well, they'll be very rich.
Shep Smith in the anchor chair?
Either Shep Smith or Britt Hume, and I'm putting my money on Shep Smith. They've really been grooming him as America's anchorman of the next generation. He's the anti-Dan Rather. He does not lecture to the viewers the way that anchors did 30 or 40 years ago. He gets straight to the point. Now, critics would say he also makes it too dumbed down, rushes through the news, but he definitely knows how to get those younger viewers because he gives the news quickly, for instance.
You know, Brian, all this comes at a time of soul-searching for the big three broadcast networks. What do you think the entry of Fox into their turf will mean for the look and feel of their news shows? Will there be another Fox effect like there was on cable, influencing CNN, for instance, to be more conversational, to pitch personalities rather than news?
I think it's very possible that we're moving in that direction for the broadcast network news shows. And we've recently seen CBS News appoint a new president, who is also president of CBS Sports, who has absolutely no news experience whatsoever. Now, he's going to bring certain entertainment qualities of the sports programming to news. ABC and NBC could very well do similar things. If they're confronted with the prospect of a Fox evening newscast, that is really distinctive and attractive to viewers.
So let's compare the ratings for the lowest rated newscast on CBS to that of the Fox News Channel, just so people have a sense of the real numbers here.
On a good night, CBS Evening News is the number three evening newscast, and they get about 6 to 7 to 8 million viewers. Now, to contrast that, Fox News, their news broadcast with Shep Smith gets about 1.5 million viewers a night. But the trend is that Fox is going up and the broadcast networks are sliding down.
Any broadcast station has a license that is regarded as a public trust. And in it, there's some assumption that it will offer a broad range of views. And I wonder, if the Fox broadcast stations were to become Foxified to the point where they sounded like the Fox News channels, do you think that that would pose a risk to their licenses?
They would never get to the point where they're so blatantly conservative or liberal, you know, so blatantly political that they're going to lose viewers. I think they still want to be, as they say, fair and balanced. They don't want to put on shows that are clearly conservative because then they would fall into those issues of licensing and of sanctions. What they're going to interject into local newscasts may be less political and more the bells and whistles, more the sexy sort of attitude that Fox News puts on cable.
Brian, do I have you right? You may be the first person on the show who's ever used the phrase fair and balanced in connection with Fox without irony.
I think it's an ingenious marketing slogan. I'm not sure it's always true. In fact, I'm sure it's not always true. But I guess I see it as an economic thing. You know, we've heard recently that Rupert Murdoch may be aligning himself with Hillary Clinton if he thinks she's going to win, because it comes down to dollars and cents for them.
All right, Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Stelter is editor of TVNewser.com, a blog with all the latest on the TV industry. Coming up, helpful hints for faking sincerity in murder fiction and reality TV.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the Iraq War goes on, the military strains to find recruits, and once it does, combat soldiers have to be trained for war and prepped to kill. In the book Jarhead, one Marine's memoir of the first Gulf War, Anthony Swofford gave us a peek at one way to ready soldiers for battle: show them war movies. In the early 90s, soldiers watched films about Vietnam, anti-war films. But it seems that when the guns are blazing, the message is lost in the sound and the smoke. The movie based on Swofford's memoir, also called Jarhead, opens this weekend. We're joined now by Lawrence Weschler, director of New York University's Institute for the Humanities. He wrote about this trouble with war movies for the November issue of Harper's. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So in Jarhead, you've got Lance Corporal Anthony Swofford's account of his own experience during Operation Desert Storm, which was the first Gulf War.
Yeah, that was the clean, easy, triumphalist one, as we now remember it, at least from the American point of view.
And nearly unique in that hardly any shots were fired by troops on the ground.
On the ground. And what was interesting, just in the lead up to the current war, Swofford issued this memoir that he had written 10 years after the fact. And it turned out to be a much more troubled war for the people who fought it than you might have thought. And I think for a lot of people, one of the most shocking things in it was the fact that in the buildup to the war, the way the Marines goosed themselves into getting ready to kill was by screening Vietnam films, many of these really anti-war films.
It is strange. And in the movie of the book, director Sam Mendes makes use of a scene that occurred at the 29 Palms Marine Corps base in California, where Swofford was stationed before shipping out to the Middle East. At that point, Swofford and his fellow Marines were watching a movie, and it wasn't just any movie.
Well, they're getting ready to go to war, and they are watching Apocalypse Now, which I think you and I remember as kind of a horrified anti-war film at the end of the day, but which they are experiencing, particularly that amazing scene of the Valkyrie helicopter raid, you know, with the Wagner music and Robert Duvall.
We're coming low out of the rising sun, and about a mile out, we'll put on the music.
Music?
Yeah, I use Wagner. It scares the hell out of the slopes. My boys love it.
This gung-ho cavalry, air cavalry colonel taking the Marines in with this incredible music and wreaking mayhem. And this horrifying scene is transmuted in this new way of looking at it into basically military pornography. I mean, it's basically a way of getting your rocks off, getting excited, getting ready for your first real screw. It's interesting, by the way, when Wagner is premiering the Valkyrie in 1876, he has the orchestra not at the front of the stage, but he moves them to the side, so you'll have this kind of sense-around experience. He is basically straining toward the effect you're going to get in movies. And what he's doing is creating this thing that overwhelms you.
Would you say that films like Apocalypse Now are essentially victims of the emotional power of film? That whatever the intent of the director, any depiction of horror in past wars could be used to energize soldiers on their way to a current war.
Or to energize everybody in the audience, if you think about it. I mean, there's something about the character of film itself. There's a great line of Sam Fuller's, the great director, who said that the only way you could ever really give a sense of what war is like in film is if bullets were raining out from the screen and taking out people in the audience at random in massive carnage. Now, short of that, the experience of war in film is going to be the joy, the adrenaline pump of it, and you're not going to have the complete chaos. So oddly enough, it's not that surprising perhaps that these scenes can be used to rev people up, since it really doesn't present them with the full drama and the full import and the full implication of what's going on.
Bill Broyles Jr., who is the screenwriter for Jarhead, told you that just as soldiers of today were primed on movies about Vietnam, soldiers from the 40s were primed on World War I films like All Quiet on the Western Front, which was pretty unflinching for its time.
What the soldiers, once the war gets going, they remember the scenes of the marches to war, the excitement. That's what they remember. By the way, Broyles was himself a Vietnam veteran. And so he had an interesting situation where he, who had been in Vietnam, was doing a screenplay of a film by a guy who had been in the first Gulf War aimed at people who are in the second Gulf War, including, parenthetically, Broyles' own son, who is currently in Iraq. But he was talking about the way that men return from war and try to make cautionary tales for young men, and all the young men hear is the excitement of it. And I think that was one of the things they were playing with in Jarhead, whether they could transcend that.
You know, a film released just before Apocalypse Now was The Deer Hunter. Yeah. Taken together, they were received by critics and the audience as anti-war statements, anti-Vietnam statements anyway. But do you think that they were representative of something larger?
Well, what was interesting at the time is that both Cimino, who did The Deer Hunter, and Coppola were making huge claims for these films. In fact, Coppola at the time was quoted as saying, if the audience can just go and see what we did there, we'll somehow be able to get it behind us. At the time, I was really troubled by the aspiration of a film that would get it behind us. Like, what kind of crazy thing is that to
think? It would cure us.
It would cure us. And by the way, who were we to be cured? It was the Vietnamese, if anybody, who needed to be healed from it. But one of the things that was really strange is that in both those films, the central fulcrum of the films were really weird and frankly racist. In the case of Apocalypse Now, you might remember it was this notion that the Montagnard tribesmen fell under the thrall of this godlike white guy, the Brando character, who goes over the top and has to be rescued by another weird white guy. That never happened. Nothing like that is on record as having happened. Secondly, with Cimino, though,
it was derived from a Conrad novel.
It happened in Conrad. It happened in something else, but it didn't happen in Vietnam, in fairness. Secondly, in Cimino's book, the key thing was the Viet Cong making American prisoners play Russian roulette. that never happened either. And it's worth saying that. And when you said that to people, they said, we're not dealing with just Vietnam. We're dealing with Conrad. We're dealing with Nietzsche. We're dealing with Hemingway. We're dealing with the big issues, masculinity, evil, horror, you know, so forth. And at that point, I remember just thinking, wait a second. There is nothing bigger than Vietnam. Trying to get Vietnam right is what mattered.
Coppola told you that he never really thought of Apocalypse Now as anti-war. In any case, he thought that a true anti-war film would have to be set far away from the battlefield.
Yeah. Oddly enough, Sam Mendes and Walter Murch and Swofford and Broyles, the screenwriter, have come up with something interesting in this case in Jarhead. It's the character of that particular war. Because indeed, for the ground forces, in the case of Swofford, who was a Marine sharpshooter who had been trained within an inch of his life for a very particular kind of military duty, he literally doesn't fire a shot. This was an entirely one-sided war, the one side in question being the air. America had air supremacy. It had been such incredible slaughter of what at the end of the day were just draftees in Saddam's army. So on the one hand, you have no scenes of kind of dynamic, exciting battle. On the other hand, you see Buchenwald kinds of situations. Like, talk about the horror, which was a great line in Apocalypse Now, but right. You want to talk about the horror of the horror. It's what these guys saw. Remember the Highway of Death, and this is all portrayed in the movie. So oddly enough, I don't think that 5 years from now, videotapes of Jarhead are going to be used at 29 Palms to get people ready for the invasion of Syria, or I guess Syria is 5 weeks from now. I don't know what the way things are going.
Because not enough bang-bang?
The wrong kind of bang-bang. What the movie asks is who gets to screw who and who gets screwed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Weschler is the director of New York University's Institute for the Humanities. His article titled Valkyries Over Iraq appears in the November issue of Harper's Magazine.
See that kid? The one dreaming of serving his country? That jarhead is me.
Now we move seamlessly from war movies to murder mysteries. Both strive for convincing portrayals of blood and guts, but to know if you're doing it right, you need a blood and guts expert. In other words, a doctor. Dr. Rob Bedeker is an infectious disease specialist by training and an advisor to would-be mystery writers by avocation. He enjoys a clever murder as long as it's based on biological truth. To make sure it is, he delivers a lecture he calls Gunshots, Arsenic, and Bleeding Out Your Eyes, a physician's view on writing about murder, poisons, and bioterrorism. Dr. Bedeker doesn't waste time on niceties. In the classroom, he gets straight to the point.
What I do at the beginning of the class is I go around the room and say, could you just give your first name and tell me who you want to kill and why? And last year, a lot of them wanted to have people commit suicide. So I altered my talk and I went more heavily into the poisonings. This year, they all were writing murder mystery stories and they all wanted to know, you know, how deep the knife had to go.
So what question do you get asked the most?
What I find the students are most interested in is when I have a picture of the neck and they start saying, well, what if I stab instead of slash?
So tick off what you say in your lecture. What are, say, the top few points for getting the gore right?
Here's the title. Doc, how much time do I got? And I have bullet to the heart, brain, pretty much instant death. Punctured lung, seconds to minutes. Punctured artery, minutes to hours. Special attention to bleeding into a body cavity, ruptured liver or spleen, minutes, hours, or days, depending on how much you want the person to bleed. Spinal cord injury could be instantaneous paralysis or paralysis that develops over hours. Shattered bone, probably not going to kill you, but that limb is useless. You're not going to hobble like they do in the action-adventure movies.
On the ABC series Lost, somebody pulled a bullet out of his own arm. How likely is that?
It sounds rather painful.
You don't need a medical degree to guess that.
If the bullet is so close to the surface that you can pluck it out, you could just leave it alone. It'll fall out on its own in a few days.
You are a doctor, and there are an awful lot of doctor dramas on television. Have you ever watched, say, an episode of ER and gotten just royally teed off?
I've watched one episode. I was in medical school and was home visiting, and they had somebody coming in. They were coding the patient, doing chest compressions, rolling in the machines, and they had the person's EKG up on the screen, the monitor where you could see it, and somebody yelled out, He's in VFib. Shock him. And I was running around the room. He's not in VFib. He's in VTAC. Don't shock him. And my mother told me to be quiet. And I never watched ER again after that.
I know that you advise writers. So is it okay if I read to you from a novel, The Murder Scene?
Sure.
He took out the hatchet and raised it with both his hands, hardly feeling what he was doing, and almost with no effort, almost mechanically, struck her on the head with the back of it. He struck her again and again with all his strength, and then again, every time with the back of the hatchet and across the crown of the head. Blood gushed out as from an overturned tumbler, and she fell straight on her back. He drew her away to let her fall, and then at once bent over her face. She was dead. So what do you think?
Beautiful.
But what I'm asking here is that if he bashes her on the crown of her head, will the blood gush out like water?
It could. If you smash the skull and one of those bone shards severs an artery that feeds the brain, you can get quite a bit of blood squirting out. Not very far, but enough to let you know that you did some damage.
Well, I'm sure Dostoevsky would be very glad that Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment knew how to kill that pawnbroker. Dr. Bedeker, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Rob Bedeker is an infectious disease specialist at Temple University, and he spoke to us from Philadelphia.
If you're looking for fame, adventure, or a new house, but you haven't got the talent, the time, or the money, there's a shortcut to your dreams, reality television. And if you're looking for a shortcut to reality TV, there's RTVStar.com. It's a kind of central clearinghouse for aspiring survivors and bachelors and apprentices who can create a profile with a common application, a short video, and some photos, all searchable by casting directors in need of the real deal. It's the brainchild of Brian Ostrovsky, and he joins us now. Brian, welcome to our own little reality show.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, Bob.
Okay, so was there some sort of eureka moment where you just realized that the world needs a central clearinghouse for reality TV wannabes?
There really was. It started when I was going through the application process to The Apprentice 2. I was like most Americans, no idea what was involved. I learned that there was a 14-page application, there was a video, and between life and work, didn't get it done. My wife subsequently applied to a couple shows on cable, you know, makeover your dining room type shows. And, well, we never heard back. We didn't get cast, all of those things. And it was just one night in January, I'm watching American Idol, and it hit me. There were a lot of Americans like us that there was no easy way to go through the application process, and RTVStar.com was born.
Members fill out a written application, but they also upload a short video of themselves. On average, do you think that people sort of get it, or are they making wildly wrong decisions in what they submit?
I think people right now generally try to do too much or try to be what the casting pro or the network wants them to be. Unfortunately, you can't keep that up 24 hours a day, so it's really not the right approach. What they really are looking for is interesting people being themselves. Now, not everyone is interesting, so unfortunately not everyone will be on television, but they want to see what makes you worthy of being watched.
We actually have an excerpt of one submission. Can you tell me what it is we're about to hear?
It's two gentlemen from West Hollywood talking about each other and talking about why they love The Amazing Race and what it means to them, which is really an endearing quality because it shows that they're passionate about the show that they want to be on.
And I will admit, I get down to the last 5 minutes of the show, as the people racing towards the finish, and it's like, oh my God, they gotta get there! Hurry, yeah.
And you know, we just kind of, you know, keep thinking about what we would be like in certain situations that have been represented on the show. And
we would kick ass.
Is there a type? Is there someone who's just more likely to be a reality TV wannabe than somebody else?
We really expected to see a tight grouping of the younger generation, but it's been across the board. Now, we know that, in particular, college students want to be on reality TV. It's easy. You just look at MTV and you look at The Real World, and you see that demographic represented more vibrantly than the older demographic. However, there is significant presence within the 40 and 50-something, the boomers, who say, you know what, I can do Survivor. I'm tough enough. I can do The Amazing Race. I want to travel the world.
I just turned 40. I want to show these young whippersnappers that we still can do something.
I've hit that middle-aged mark, and I really want to make sure that I make a great representation of the 40-year-old crowd.
Yeah. Bring us on your show.
Put us on your show.
Now, I know you've only been in business for a few months now, but has any of your applicants actually been cast on a reality show?
Well, you know, even before we opened up our doors, so to speak, we had a request from Blind Date for a gentleman, and a friend of a friend was interested. He's a med student. He ended up getting cast on the show and went out on a date. Hasn't aired yet.
So but, then the answer to my question is no.
Oh, well, we haven't got anyone who has become a member on a show yet.
I have to applaud your entrepreneurial spirit. I really do. But as someone interested in the forward march of civilization, please convince me that we're not taking a few steps backwards here.
Hmm. Very philosophical question to ask about a reality television. I think we need diversions, and reality television should really be looked at as a diversion, much like any other form of entertainment. I myself have not traveled much, and being on The Amazing Race would be just a fantastic opportunity were I able to do so. So whether or not we're pushing the civilization forward, I think the industry in a whole is able to give people opportunities that working the 9-to-5 for 40 hours and retiring wouldn't afford them otherwise.
Hey, is this all just a Trojan horse to get you on Amazing Race? Like the Hair Club for Men guy, are you also a client?
I am also a client. I had thought of that after we started the business, that it would be quite ironic if I ended up getting on a show because I did a business featuring reality television. It is not a Trojan horse, however.
Well, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Brian Ostrovsky is founder and CEO of RTVStar.com.
Coming up, denial, depression, and acceptance in the music biz and the Tao of mental hygiene movies.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The recording industry is in a bad way. What began as a slump in the face of Napster and other file-sharing technologies is beginning to look like chronic wasting disease. Josh Bernoff is a media analyst for Forrester Research, who's been tracking the industry for 6 years. He says the music industry has responded to its condition in a manner more human than corporate. In fact, he sees a reaction similar to the one psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross famously observed in patients facing a terminal illness: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. Bernoff admits he's not the first to discern this pattern, which he says runs through the media business, but he saw the music business enter the first stage back in 1999.
What we saw happen there was a lot of denial, hey, this isn't really a problem, followed by anger. We're going to sue these guys. We're going to stop this. You can't do this to us.
Tell me about the bargaining part of things. How did that play out?
It was an attempt to grapple with the problem. They said, you can have any music you want as long as it's by subscription. Yes, you can have download music, but no, you're not allowed to burn it to your own CDs. They hadn't quite accepted the fact that they had to completely change the way they do business.
When you say they, is it the labels? Is it the recording artists? Is it just everybody?
Well, the two main collaborators here were the music labels and the music retailers, the stores that sold the music, that thought they were in the business of selling pieces of plastic. And for quite a while, they just raised the price a little bit. People continued to buy music because they didn't have any choice.
Which led, you said, to the depression stage, which manifested itself how?
With a lot of depression. During the period from 2001 to 2003, there were 277 articles in Billboard magazine about layoffs, not just in the music labels, but also in the retail companies. And if you lost your job, you were not going to be coming back because there was just no room left for recording executives.
Let's talk about Hollywood. Now, I see Hollywood in the form of the Motion Picture Association of America desperately fighting against peer-to-peer technology out of fears of piracy of very expensive to produce Hollywood films. But you see a much more adaptive industry. Tell me about that.
Well, the movie industry in the 70s was a lot like the music industry is now. When the new technology came up, at that time it was VCRs, they reacted in a way that included anger. You had Jack Valenti saying that the VCR was like the Boston Strangler for content. But in the 30 years since then, they now make more money from video cassettes and DVDs than they do at the box office. They embraced HBO, and they are now embracing new technologies like internet downloads and video on demand from your cable operator. So even as they attempt to fight piracy, which is probably going to have very much the same result as it did in the music business, that is, not much, they have a whole lot more ways to continue to make money in the face of it.
Is there anyone else who should be paying attention to Kubler-Ross and taking care that it becomes more proactive instead of just a cliche of a psychological breakdown?
Well, one industry that's now in sort of the middle stages of this sort of dealing with the problem is the newspaper business. There's so many sources of news on the internet that you see a decline in newspaper circulation. You also see an enormous amount of their other source of revenue, that is classified advertising, getting sucked up by internet sites like Monster.com. Hundreds of people have been laid off from places like the New York Times and Knight Ridder.
Their problem isn't that they don't accept the threat of the internet. Every newspaper had a website at a very early stage. It's trying to extract revenue from it that has been the ongoing problem, isn't it?
Even as newspapers embraced the internet by putting their news online, they didn't really face up to the fact that a newspaper in an online environment is not the same thing as a newspaper in print. They also haven't accepted, for example, that they should sell classified ads to people online, even if they don't want to put ads in print in the paper. So while that transition has been taking place, it's a question of reaching the consumer the way the consumer needs to be reached, desires to be reached, and also finding ways to make more money from it.
Okay, that's a good answer. Now I got another one for you. I've actually witnessed sessions between psychological counselors and those who have terminal illnesses. The counselors have a message to deliver, but it seems to me that often the victims and the victims' families are so caught up in their own personal tragedy that they're really not paying a whole lot of attention. Let's say you're right. Is there anybody in any of these industries who is learning anything from what you have to say?
You know, it's really interesting that you ask that. We actually initiated this research because a diversified media company that included both print and television wanted to know what the music lessons were, the lessons from the music industry. So I came in and talked to these executives, and they said, yeah, there's really a lot to learn here. What does this mean for television? We began to talk about ad skipping and digital video recorders, and they basically came to the conclusion that, well, we need to wait and see just how bad this is. And I pointed out that that probably is exactly the same kind of discussions that were happening in the boardrooms of the music labels when they were facing their transition. What it requires is that people embrace things that aren't going to make money immediately. A very good example of this is Bob Iger, who recently made available the shows Lost and Desperate Housewives, Disney shows now on Apple iTunes. Now, that's a radical move, and it probably isn't going to make that much money to begin with. And it's very upsetting to many of the people who work with Disney and ABC. And yet, it's a way for that company to say, we're going to do things differently. And then, if our main revenue stream gets threatened, at least we're going to have something to fall back on.
Okay. Well, Josh, Thank you very much.
It's been good to talk to you.
Josh Bernoff is a media analyst for Forrester Research. His study is titled Music Lessons, Is Your Industry at Risk? And now for a few of your letters. On our story about the past and future of the nightly network news, Maria Garcia of New York City said we displayed evidence of the digital divide. Quote, do you really imagine your listeners have the time to blog? You reported the ways in which the internet is changing the public's access to news and about the average person's disgust with avuncular news anchors. I couldn't agree more. I don't watch network news. I watch the Lehrer News Hour and BBC News, and I listen to On the Media. I read The New Yorker. Some days when I'm not down on the New York Times, I read it online. But I don't have time to blog, and frankly, I'm not interested in reading everybody else's opinion of what's going on.
We also received some very specific suggestions from listener Catherine Barrett on what would constitute an effective news anchor for our time. She writes, we trust Jon Stewart, but we don't see him as a teacher or mentor. We want our journalists, especially our TV news anchors, to be both teacher mentors and to encourage us to know more and think deeply. But we must also trust what they say. I think a wise, strong, no-nonsense black woman, about 50 to 60, would be the best bet as the new model of anchor. What she could bring across would be, she has your best interests at heart, and she has also played the game well enough to rise to the top so she can also help you navigate this complicated world.
And finally this from Ron Elligator of Larchmont, New York, who says he usually listens online. He says he's wondered for a long time why he likes the show so much. Ron, sometimes it's not so clear to us either, but he finally came up with a reason. Quote, for example, your story on a pharma guy commissioning a novel about terrorists tainting prescription drugs from Canada would be suitable for your April Fool's show. If it weren't true, thank you. No, Ron, thank you and everyone else for their comments and criticisms and occasional compliments. Keep sending them to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Ted Paychak died last month. If you came of age soon after World War II and ever sat through a classroom screening of a cautionary tale about the dangers of shyness or the virtues of soap and water, odds are Ted Paychak directed that film. They were called hygiene films, and Paychak was the master of the genre.
Jenny thinks that she has the key to popularity, parking in cars with the boys at night. When Jerry brags about taking Ginny out, he learns that she dates all the boys, and he feels less important.
That was from a film called Are You Popular, which seems like nothing more than a bit of Eisenhower-era kitsch, but for Ken Smith, the author of the oral history Mental Hygiene, Paychak's 10-minute filmic gems like Clothes and You and Friendship Begins at Home applied new techniques to an old problem, best summed up as the teen years. Ken, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Brooke.
So how were you introduced to these instructional films, and what about them drew you?
Well, I was working as a continuity writer for the Comedy Channel back when it first started, and they had a collection of these films. One of my many jobs was to cut them up into 30-second clips that they could run when a commercial dropped out. So I started to watch them, obviously, to find the funny bits, and it didn't take long before I realized there was a lot more going on to these films than just, you know, bad haircuts and really, really stilted acting. So I started asking around, and nobody knew anything. I mean, nobody cared. Educational establishment hated these films because they considered them an embarrassment. And the film community hated these films because they considered them an embarrassment. And when you think about it, more people saw these films than any other film. I mean, millions and millions of baby boomers had to sit. I did. I had to sit through these films when I was in school. to me, it was amazing that no one cared.
So who was Ted Paycheck?
Ted was an ex-Signal Corps cameraman out of World War II, and he was bitten by the film bug, as a lot of servicemen were during the war. And when they got out, there was a gentleman by the name of David Smart, the publisher of Esquire, a multi-millionaire. And in 1936, he had gone to Nazi Germany to the Olympics, and he saw how the Nazis were using film, especially in classrooms, to brainwash kids. And he decided he would take his money and create good classroom films, positive classroom films, democratic classroom films that would teach American kids how to be good citizens.
That is a bit worrisome, though, taking your cue from the Nazis.
Well, and David Smart was Jewish, too. But he built this huge studio on his estate in Glenview, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago, and poured millions of dollars into the idea that a film can be used to adjust attitudes, I believe was the operative phrase at the time. The theory was what they called the substitute peer group. You would sit down and you would see these kids who were nicer than nice. They would look like you, and they would talk like you, and they would live in the same kind of neighborhood you did, and they would have the same problems you did. And so that when you were confronted with a moral dilemma, you would remember the film that you saw, and you would remember what Chuck or Betty or Carolyn did in the film, and you would follow their example rather than the example of your friends.
Some fellows seem to think that petting's well thing to do.
And some girls think that they have to permit it for date insurance.
David Smart hired Ted and one other guy, Gil Altschul. And between them, they each directed 25 films a year for the next 15 years. Each would take a film every other week. They'd shoot it, and then they'd spend a week cleaning it up and cutting it and editing it and then getting ready for the next film. And then we'd do that, 50 weeks out of the year and get 2 weeks vacation. And he said he got so good at the end, he actually shot an entire film in a day. And he was really proud of that. And he was telling me, he said, if we had just kept going, I bet I could have done two films a day. And he, that the pride he took in being able to grind this stuff out so fast.
So you mentioned attitude adjustment, but what sorts of adjustments were they going for? I mean, Smart was a mentor to Hugh Hefner. He was a very progressive guy for his time.
Well, yes, he was. The people who made these films were among the more liberal-minded of their time. The conservative people were against these films because they felt that school was not a proper place to teach morality. They felt that that was the domain of the church and the home, the family. Classroom films have been around since the 19-teens, believe it or not. I mean, Edison invented film as a tool of education, not as a tool of entertainment. But the films back then were more what we would regard as an illustrated lecture. It was
how a bill becomes a law.
Right. So when Coronet came along and they used the techniques of filmmaking, they used plots, they used music, they used atmospheric lighting. I mean, that was really revolutionary for the time, using the tricks of Hollywood and applying them into a classroom, which, again, was very, very frightening to a lot of conservative parents and school boards.
You've written that both parents and educators were worried that the 50s were going to be a repeat of the lost generation of the 20s. Were these films an attempt to allay parents' fears?
And that was one of the ways they sold these films. You've got parents and you've got teachers. They don't know how to talk about sex or a substance abuse with their kids. They still don't know how to talk about sex and substance abuse with their kids. So you've got a film. Okay, this film is supposedly created by experts. It's the perfect advice frozen in celluloid. You wheel it into the classroom, you turn it on, the kids watch the film. You don't have to think about it. The film has solved all your problems.
Up until this point, what were the images available to teenagers that spoke about their lives? We had Rebel Without a Cause. We had some big Hollywood productions.
But they didn't come along until 1955. We're talking 10 years before that these films really dominated the scene. Hollywood played a big role in shifting teen attitudes from that point on. Certainly rock and roll came in 1955, too. There was a lot of forces that were working on teenagers that these films couldn't control. Again, when these films first appeared, they were it. You imagine a classroom in 52, they wheel a projector in and all of a sudden they're showing a film with you supposedly up on the screen. That had to have been a powerful thing at the time. I don't think we appreciate that monopoly these films had for a good period of years.
So as the 50s gave way to the 60s, did these films keep pace with the times?
No. Mental hygiene films couldn't. Their whole theory was based on this sort of subtle imaginary world manipulation, and kids could see that that was not the real world anymore, and the films couldn't issue these kind of dogmatic, moralistic pronouncements in light of things like the civil rights movement and Vietnam and the whole drug culture of the 60s. That just you couldn't do it.
So, Ken, do you have a favorite moment in a favorite film?
Oh, golly. I would say probably the end of Shy Guy, where Phil is in the basement surrounded by his friends, and the music swells up, and you realize that he's going to be accepted by the gang. I mean, that really kind of sums it all up. You know, it was just a beautiful, very touching early 1950s moment of conformity. Like, yay, he was accepted by the gang.
Well, one shy guy is on his way. Not that his worries are over. He'll still have his moments of doubt, of hesitation, of fear that he might do something wrong. But he can face these problems now because he knows that he's not really different.
Again, we laugh at the concept, but back then, it was the geeks of today were considered the delinquents of tomorrow. You know, somebody sitting in their basement all by themselves, that's bad. That's very, very bad. You got to get the guy out of the basement and into dating girls. That was the solution, you know.
And now the geeks of today are the millionaires of tomorrow.
I know. It's interesting the way these things work out.
Ken, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Brooke.
Ken Smith is the author of Mental Hygiene, Classroom Films, 1945 to 1970.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Wallow, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.